This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group.
Hello, I'm Dr. Susanna Lipscomb, a historian at the University of Roehampton, and you're listening to Irreplaceable, a history of England in 100 places. In this series, we explore the 100 amazing places that help tell the story of England. And today we reveal the final top 10 locations in the faith and belief category, as chosen by the judge, the very Reverend Dr. David Ison, from your nominations. Today I'm joined for the last time by journalists Hazel Southam and Ramona Ali, as well as Historic England's Dr. Joe Flatman. Remember, you can join in our conversation. Just use the hashtag 100 places to tell us about the irreplaceable locations on your doorstep. And if you're enjoying the series, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We begin with the Quakers and one of the oldest Quaker meeting houses in the world. Founded in 1689, the Farfield Quaker Meeting House sits along the Dales Way in West Yorkshire. The year in which it was founded is key in the story of this modest stone building, for 1689 was the year the Act of Toleration was passed by Parliament. This was an act permitting non-conformist groups the freedom to worship, as long as they swore allegiance to the king and weren't Catholic. This meant a group of Quakers who held secret meetings in this part of Yorkshire were able to openly worship and found this building, one of the earliest Quaker meeting houses. In his notes, Judge David Ison points to the rootedness of Christian non-conformism in the English landscape.
I wanted to find something which spoke of the non-conformist tradition. It was the Reformation in the 1500s which opened that up to what can be called dissent or non-conformity. There were punishments administered by the government initially for non-conformity in religion. The Quakers were one of the earliest dissident groups in the 17th century, and they were persecuted. And the Fairfield Quaker Meeting House in West Yorkshire, I have a soft spot for it because I used to live in Bradford, so it's not too far away. But it's one of those country places which remind you of a whole aspect of religious history, which, again, sometimes gets forgotten now. And the importance of the nonconformist and dissident tradition in shaping, again, the economic life and the social life of our country was enormous in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Hazel, what's the story of the Quakers in this particular part of Yorkshire?
So in this particular part of Yorkshire, the Quakers really have a chap called Anthony Myers to thank, who's a local yeoman, a local farmer. And he allowed them onto his land and gave them not exactly a barn, because it's a lovely little stone building over in the corner, as a place that they could worship in safety without any persecution. It does seem bonkers, doesn't it, actually, that Quakers should have been persecuted when their whole ethos is about modesty, tolerance, pacifism. That really slightly plays with my head. But anyway, good old Anthony Myers gives them space, and it's a space that's still there today.
And does it reflect these qualities that you're talking of in terms of the Quaker faith?
Very much so, because it's incredibly simple. There are no adornments. You don't go in, maybe like a Church of England church or a Catholic church. And I guess the idea there is that you're not distracted, but you are able just to focus in on God. So mindfulness several hundred years ago.
Most importantly, perhaps, this building represents a point in time when the nation's freedom of belief and the acceptance of other versions of faith took a liberal step forwards, and it still stands as a testament to that today. And there are still 17,000 Quakers in Britain today, but I think it's really important to remember that there was a stage in which nonconformism was something that had to be approved by Act of Parliament in our history. Do you think we take our religious freedom for granted these days?
For sure.
Absolutely.
We absolutely take it for granted. We have so many religious freedoms in the UK, I mean, compared to other places in the world. And, you know, there is religious persecution that is sadly prevailing against so many people. So I'm very grateful to be in Britain in the 21st century.
And me too, because both of us can go to our respective places of worship and worship freely and honestly and openly without any fear of what might happen to us. And I think that we maybe, as a society, overlook that opportunity. And so I think, you know, this whole series is called Irreplaceable. And I think our little local places of worship are the irreplaceable ones. And I'd urge anybody, whether they have a faith or not, just to go into their local place, because we need to keep that sense of religious freedom going. We need to explore it for ourselves, whatever that might mean, all the doubts that come with that. And we need to keep those spaces redolent with prayer for future generations.
And Quaker meeting houses are just such wonderful places for different religious groups to come together. So recently, I know there was a humanist and a Muslim dialogue that took place in a Quaker meeting house. And I just love that.
Because it's such a space that you could do that.
Yeah, I think the simplicity
and the Quakers are totally welcome
that.
And actually, that speaks to the history of Quakerism as well, which, you know, and their central belief that all people are created equal in the eyes of God, was so important in the past, because they were actively campaigning for the abolition of the slave trade before we have William Wilberforce, because they didn't believe that one person could own another. The Quakers formed a petition committee and campaign group to lobby Parliament in the late 18th century, boycotted Caribbean Sugar, and commissioned a Wedgwood design featuring a slave in chains with words, "Am I not a man and a brother?" So the journey this group had taken in gaining their religious freedom, along with their egalitarian principles, put them at the forefront of early parliamentary lobbying and social change in this crucial area of the abolition of slavery. And I suppose there's a sense in which the way in which religion can work towards social justice is commemorated in this meeting house, I suppose, the Quaker faith. That still is the case, of course, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic aspect of the Quaker faith, that they fought for social justice and, you know, they stood against oppression. That really speaks to me for sure, and I think it speaks to many people of faith. And also that the Quaker women were very, very important in the spreading of the Quaker faith. And there was spiritual equality between men and women. And that's something that speaks to my own faith as a Muslim. And often women seem to be written out of our histories. You know, we need to bring them back in. There is a rich legacy of women's contributions there. You know, from the Islamic tradition, there's a lost legacy of female scholars. You know, one scholar found 8,000 accounts, a modern day scholar found over 8,000 accounts of female scholars. Yet that's something that's missing from our not just from our history books, but also from our conscience.
Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it? And I think the Quakers were a particular group of Christians who really took to heart the notion of priesthood, the priesthood of all believers and everyone being equal. Well, we're now off to our 10th and final faith and belief location, for which we're going to East London. David selected a building that's been a centre for multiple beliefs and congregations since its construction in the 18th century.
Brick Lane Mosque is, in some ways, the most interesting of all these places, because of its history over a relatively short amount of time, but the way that different faiths and beliefs have shaped the places around them, and yet how the place has shaped the expression of that belief. So you have this building which starts as a place for French Huguenots, becomes a Methodist church, that's a very different Christian tradition, and then turns into a synagogue as the Jews move out into East London, and then becomes a mosque as the Muslim Bangladeshi community moves out. So you've got this huge adaptation, and it's about the fact that we're willing to adapt and change. I mean, I think it's a very proud history, really, that in this area of London, it's been able to accommodate so many different people from different backgrounds and different faiths, and help them to become part of wider society.
This building has a fascinating history and has been a faith centre for an ever-changing community since its inception. It's now housed the three Abrahamic religions across three centuries, and it's a building with many layers of history, as David was saying. Well, tell us more about the history, Joe.
The history is spoken both through the survival of this building, but then the communities around it. So back in the mid-18th century, it's built as a French Protestant church, and at that time, that piece, part of East London, which was already by then really quite developed and built up, would have had a lot of French Protestant, the Huguenot communities around it, who are effectively refugees. Let's call them refugees. They're fleeing persecution. And so at that point, you would have heard French being spoken in that area. It then changes as London changes and becomes a different type of multicultural area. In the 19th century, it becomes a synagogue, and that's where you get a lot of the traditions, still of which there are fragments to this day in East London, of the Jewish communities. And then again in the 20th century, as we see the changes again of the Jewish communities in London, and they are still in London, but they tend to have moved to different areas. The swathes of the next immigrant communities in that, but London, with Muslim communities, particularly one Muslims of Bangladeshi origin, the site then gets turned into a mosque much more recently in the 1970s. And this is, as David said earlier, it's the microcosm of different types of communities coming in. They focus on that religious site, but they're not exclusive to that. That is why people to this day want to go to an area like that, because you get that incredible buzz of the humanity.
And there's a sense in which this particular building has been a refuge for Huguenots, for Jews fleeing persecution, even after partition, and thinking about Muslims coming to this country.
It's a wonderful sanctuary for all these different religious minorities. And Brick Lane Mosque is almost like it's an Olympic torch of faith that kind of passes, you know, from one religion to the other. And it just keeps burning. It's just such a wonderful example of this kind of a harmony of different religions and this kind of flourishing of that. You know, it's like a canvas that you know, it's like coloured by so many different religions.
You have a personal relationship with this mosque, don't you?
I have prayed there, and I feel quite connected to the concept of it, especially the minaret that's been recently erected. Just, it's not quite part of the building, but it's kind of on the street. So it's kind of between two worlds. And I feel that's kind of symbolizes what I am as well. And a lot of the kind of first generation immigrant communities feel, where you're from two places, but also there's a beautiful harmony with that as well. You're kind of like the outsider and the insider, and you have this kind of beautiful harmony of different worlds coming together. And I think that's really symbolised in the mosque and Brick Lane.
It's now named the Jama Masjid, and today it's a spiritual hub for the Muslim community in this part of London and beyond. What does Jama Masjid mean, Ramona?
So Jama is actually the Arabic word for a congregation. So it's about a community coming together and worshipping. And actually, it's more of a universal word, really, for all the different communities that have worshipped there in the past.
We went along to hear more.
My name's Shahid Saleem. I'm an architect. I'm the author of a book called The British Mosque, An Architectural and Social History, where I look at the architectural narrative of the mosque in Britain. We're standing on Brick Lane in East London, in Spitalfields, just very close to the city. And we're standing outside the Brick Lane Jami Masjid, which is the Brick Lane Mosque. And it's a very handsome Georgian building that was built in 1743. And just on the side of it, there's a three-storey house, which was built at the same time. And when we enter through the main doors of the house, and then we go through a side door into the main prayer hall. So we'll do that now. So today we've come in just after the midday prayer, and there's some people here who are carrying out their own sort of private prayer in the mosque, so it's very quiet, and so people are just coming and going. This is a fully functioning mosque. There's five daily prayers. They start from early in the morning at sunrise, then there's one at around lunchtime, mid-afternoon, sunset and evening, and there's a sort of prayer clock, and gives you the timings of all the prayers throughout the day. So people will come from the local area and they'll take part in the congregational prayers. And then on the left-hand side, there's a set of double doors, and this connects through to the prayer hall, to the main worship space. So if we go through the doors here, so now we're standing inside the main prayer hall. And this space that you see here, there's a few people carrying out their private worship, but other than that, it's empty at the moment. And you can really get a sense of the scale and the size of the hall. And this was the original Huguenot church. It's been a Methodist chapel, and it's been a synagogue, and now it's a mosque. In the corner, which is the southeast corner of this prayer hall, you can see that there's what's called a mihrab, which is the place where the imam will lead the congregational prayer, and that's facing towards Mecca. I think this has capacity for probably about 1,500 people in the two prayer halls. here they would have sermons in Bengali, English, and parts of it would be in Arabic. There'll be a lot of local people who will, predominantly Bangladeshi origin, who will be coming and using the mosque. Then there'll be a lot of people coming on Fridays in particular from who are working in the area, because the city is very close by. This area, Spitalfields, has been undergoing rapid changes. I mean, it's always been a place which has changed through the coming of communities, resettling of different communities and communities moving again. So this street, Brick Lane, that we're on has really seen a huge amount of very intense social, cultural, economic activities, from street markets, a large brewery just up the road, which was a big employer in the area and a very significant part of this area as well. The Spitalfields Market, which is one street away. When the Bangladeshi community settled here, there was a big, and the Jewish community, in fact, there was a big clothing trade. People used to say when you stood on Brick Lane, you could just hear sewing machines going on all the time. The mosque is a building within that area, which is emblematic again of that process of change. So all of the kind of social and cultural processes. So it's very sort of resonant with all of that sort of life and activity.
Education, of course, is often an element of religious buildings. This particular building was originally the vestry and school to the French Protestant chapel, but that's true of lots of religions, isn't it?
That's right. And if you think about rural churches in the UK, they will have been probably the place where children had what little education they did a few hundred years ago. Sunday school would be the first place that you might learn to read and write. There may have been nothing more than that. So actually, places like this give you not just your faith, not just the sense of refuge, which is fantastically important, but also an education as well.
And there's something about that sense that faith provides a unifying factor, either for children being educated, for the community, through being a sort of anchor, especially for those who are coming to the country for the first time. It's an anchor in a place that's unfamiliar to them.
Yes, exactly. It is an anchor. When people came from the Indian subcontinent, they established two things. They established places of worship, mosques or gurdwaras or temples, and also they established places they could eat. So like meat shops were also established for the Muslim communities. But it was somewhere that they needed to focus. All the community had to come together. They needed a place that they could call their own in a land that was becoming their new home. So they needed to lay their own roots, really, and feel that real sense of belonging and a new identity that was forging.
And what I really love about this one, as our last one to end on, is that it does have these layers, that it tells the sort of complexity of the religious story of England in its own building, within its own bricks. And that's where we finish our faith and belief category. We hope you've enjoyed hearing and learning about these inspiring places. To recap, we've covered Stonehenge in Wiltshire, the Holy Island of Lindisfarne in Northumberland, Ladies Well in Northumberland, Canterbury Cathedral and St Martin's Church in Kent, St Andrew's Church in Essex, Guru Nanak Gurdwara in Birmingham, Fountains Abbey in North Yorkshire, the Jewish Cemetery in Falmouth, Cornwall, Farfield Quaker Meeting House in West Yorkshire, and Brick Lane Mosque in East London. Of course, there are so many more important locations besides, so before we go, I asked David Eisen if he felt anything was missing from his top 10 list.
The additional choice that I came up with has a particular resonance, I think, because of its nature as an institution. And that's the two churches of St Bartholomew, St Bartholomew the Great and St Bartholomew the Less, in Smithfield, London. Originally, there was a medieval priory founded by somebody called Rahir in fulfilment of a religious vow as a place to care for the sick and needy. And that became St Bartholomew's Hospital, Bart's. And St Bartholomew the Less is a chapel, basically, within the environs of Bart's Hospital. And just over the road is the old Priory Church of St Bartholomew, famous in the film Four Weddings and a Funeral. But it's a wonderful medieval survival. Wasn't bombed in the Blitz or burned down in the Great Fire of London. The fact that Bart's Hospital still survives is a fantastic testimony to that continuity of care which comes out of the vision of faith.
Thank you very much to David, Hazel, Ramona and Joe for such an interesting discussion of these fascinating places. I'm Susanna Lipscomb, and next time we'll explore the top 10 places in our industry, trade and commerce category, which have been chosen by Dr. Tristram Hunt from your nominations. why not get in touch and join the conversation using the hashtag 100 places? And while you're at it, leave us a review on iTunes. See you next time.
This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group. When it feels irreplaceable, trust Ecclesiastical.